Good morning and welcome back to Excerpts from the ABBA Archives, the podcast. It's not about ABBA, it's about
Dune!
My name is A. Kirby, and with me as always is
Dune! B. Peterson. It is week 4 of Dune. Or 5, I don't know.
Dune month.
Dune month! Let's start with the other stuff again. Mm-hmm. We watched 3 movies that weren't Dune. Can you believe
Whoa.
It? Wild.
Dang.
Our packing process has officially begun. We are packing up to move.
Mm-hmm.
And if we want to start moving stuff out into the living room, you know, to get ready to go, that means that it's going to cover up the wall with which we can on which we hang our projector. Screen, so it means that it's we're going to be not watching movies on a giant screen for several months, and so we're watching our last few that we really want to watch on a big screen.
Yeah,
and I'll probably be packing up the box, the beautifully over engineered home video box that my dad and I designed and built in the next couple days.
That's
getting
so
ready
cool.
for the move. So
it does mean we might have a window again.
Yeah, we'll have a window. That's nice. For the last few weeks, it'll be covered up by bookshelves, but and couches and chairs. Anyway, we watched 3 movies. Let's start with the one we watched last night. Let's go in reverse order. I have been just really wanting to show you one of my favorite films from the last couple of years, and I'm super glad that we got it down when we were down in L.A. during the Barnes & Noble Criterion sale, and I was super glad that it's on physical media, because for a long time it wasn't. It was only on streaming. Small Axe, Steve McQueen's Small Axe anthology, specifically his second film from that anthology, Lover's Rock, which is I just adore. It is... imagine watching it at the end of 2020, because that's when these films came out. They came out on streaming 1 week after the other, in like November, December of 2020. And after having, you know, been in isolation for so long to watch Lover's Rock, the ultimate party movie, to tell me about Lover's Rock.
Yeah. It's just about this party mm-hmm. that some people have at their house.
Yeah.
And we follow a couple characters who meet each other there and have a
various interactions.
Yeah. And yeah, it's really cool to see just like we're just hanging out in a party and watching people dance for like a long time.
Mm-hmm. This film is short. It's only about, I think, an hour and 10 minutes, a little less. But almost all of it is a party.
Yeah. And a cute romance.
Mm-hmm.
Some sweet people.
Some not sweet people.
Some not sweet people. I really like... There's this shot towards the start where it's the DJ
mm-hmm.
just warming up.
Yeah.
And it's him in an empty room just like saying
cameras up on the ceiling and looking down on the room. It's all of these films are shot absolutely gorgeously, all 5 of them. And they're all shot differently too. But yeah, this one is set. There is a shot of a wall sweating in this movie. And it's just... It is so warm and intimate and casual, and
I love how the camera moves through the dancers.
Mm-hmm.
Like it just feels so smooth to just be there among them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of beautiful shots. A lot of great just like close ups of just like really, I don't know like. You feel like you're really there
mm-hmm.
with how intimate it is.
Yeah. Especially with when all the people are, you know, life size on the wall in front of you. And yeah, I just, the bodies in motion together is just I don't dance. I am about as terrified of dancing as I would be of scuba diving. The open void of water is about as terrifying to me as moving in public. rhythmically moving in public. But
even a slow dance?
Oh, yes, definitely even a slow dance. No, there will be no dancing at our wedding. Or, like, if you want to dance, that's fine, but, like...
I'm not expecting you to dance. Hey, stop!
That's... We're talking to River. She's on the bed, and she is,
going after one of my favorite blankets.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I'd rather her go after one of your favorite blankets than my fingers.
Well, yeah, but I really like that blanket. I don't want her to tear it up.
She's been doing really well this morning. She's been very quiet. And just let go. Ow.
Don't let her. Got
bite marks.
Don't let her bite your finger.
Well, if she bites my finger, then she doesn't bite anything else.
Don't let her bite your finger. You gotta
Anyway, we were talking about Lover's Rock. The body's emotions.
I'm going to get her a toy.
Okay, yeah. Not a squeaky one. Please. Yeah. That'll ruin the audio. I can give her this sock. Here. Okay. Here. Have a sock. All right. Lover's Rock. It's great. I love just the various dynamics, how it is honest about the kinds of bad things that happen here, mm-hmm. as well. It doesn't shy away from the trauma and the violence that can happen in these kinds of places. But it, even those people, it has a place for them. The guy we all hate.
Yep.
The guy with the stupid hat.
Bammy.
He sexually assaults someone. And the film takes him to task for that. Like, the characters hate him for that. And yet, at his ending in the film is just another one of the dancers having a good time. Like, maybe he's working through his frustrations or whatever. Like, he gets his comeuppance by having his beer stolen. like, it's... It doesn't... It's... I mean... It doesn't absolve him, obviously. But it sees him as equally human as everyone else.
And it reserves a place for him.
Yeah.
In the community.
Mm-hmm.
Like it, like the bouncer type guy who, mm-hmm. who like defends the main character.
Right.
At moments, doesn't kick him out. You know, he.
Yeah.
Like, there's a very satisfying moment of...
We're making it sound like the bouncer is like, hey, you sexually assaulted someone, I'm not going to kick you out. That's not what happened.
No,
it's just, they never interact. But it's just, there is a sense of people will be safe here. That this community does keep it safe, and even if there are bad actors, that they can take care of their own. There's queerness in the movie.
Yeah.
It's where I feel most safe. If this party was going on, I would be in the upstairs room being queer. You know? Mm. The shot of the bicycle, the cut to the bicycle, it's just such a breath of fresh air, literally. And that wide shot, it's just one of my favorite shots, period. When the first time I saw it, I literally gasped.
It has that freshness of like a nice early morning.
Mm-hmm.
It feels crisp.
Mm-hmm. I adore this film. I've seen this film maybe 5 or 6 times now. I just pop it on when I want a good time. And the soundtrack is great. The a cappella scene is fantastic. Mm-hmm. When they get into the harmonizing of the just the repeating silly games over and over again, it's mesmerizing. Just it's sexy. It's yeah, it's all the things. Yeah. It's all the things. It's got everything a movie could ever need. It's got it right there.
Yeah.
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 Anyway.
Yeah, no, I really like this one. I see why you like it so much.
Yeah. So that's Lover's Rock. La Belle et la Bête.
Yeah. We finally watched La Belle et la Bête. Yeah, you have the poster for this movie on your wall, which I noted, I think, our second meeting.
Yes. The first time you came into my room.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. But we hadn't seen the movie together until now.
Yeah. I'd seen the film. I got the poster before I'd seen the film. We were just in Maui. It was there was a poster shop in Lahaina that is now gone. It burned. It was on Front Street. Vintage European posters, and I got both. So I have a for the Japanese release of John Cocteau's La Belle et la Bête. I have an original poster, and then I also have an Andy Warhol Carell poster for Fassbinder's Carell. Both originals, both not cheap. They are the largest purchases of my life. but I'm very glad I have them because they're gorgeous.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, we watched the movie.
Yeah.
And it's gorgeous. It's weird watching it with Disney have also existing.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be like, the Wicked Stepsisters, that's Cinderella, you know?
And there's actually like six of them in the book.
What?
Yeah. There's originally like six. She has like six evil sisters or something.
Oh, stars.
So
did Cinderella also have stepsisters, or did...
I don't know the history of Cinderella, but I do know the history of Beauty and the Beast.
Okay.
I don't know it very well. I haven't.
Okay. Because I'm wondering if like Cinderella took the stepsisters from Beauty and the Beast. Because I don't know.
And it could just be like common tropes. I know there's.
Or if they like when they were making their adaptation of Beauty and the Beast, they're like, we're not going to include the sisters because we already did that with Cinderella. Anyway.
Yeah.
I'm assuming. And did you see this version first or the Disney version first?
I probably saw the Disney version first, but I did see this one when I was a kid.
Okay.
And so like I always knew about it because I watched it as a kid.
Because you have it on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you watched it?
No, we got it from Netflix when you could get DVDs in the mail.
Yes, I remember those days.
And yeah, and my parents just like got it one time and then I saw it and then we sent it back and I was years later like, huh, that was a good movie and, you know,
sure.
Got my own copy.
Yeah.
But.
This movie is annoying and mesmerizing in fits and starts. Like it has two very distinct modes.
Mm-hmm.
Grating and I'm in love. And I think that's intentional on Cocteau's part.
Yeah.
The everything that is not like in the castle is deliberately as annoying as possible. The stepsisters, Jean Marais, as Avenant, the brother. It's just, it's insufferable.
Yeah.
they are shrill. They are annoying. But like, even when the dad is like going through the castle, like when he's outside in the garden, like the music is just really loud and it doesn't like totally fit the scene. And it feels just like very grating again. Like, I'm like, is this really, this doesn't feel magical. This feels like, this is really big and important. It's almost like Hans Zimmer in Dune, you know? but obviously the dad in the castle with when we're introduced to the arms and faces of the castle. And then the exact moment that Belle goes through those doors in slow motion. It's magic. It is just... There is nothing quite... I'm trying to think of a movie that is more magical. Like, that genuinely inspires that kind of wonder.
I really love the score for this movie. Mm-hmm. And I love the costumes, the sets.
The costumes.
I love the beast's, like, shoulder pads with cape, where it's like...
They're really big. Maybe the one part of the beast design that I'm like, that's a lot. That's a lot of shoulder.
I think it's a lot, but I'm like, yes. Nice.
The beast look is obviously gorgeous. I think the beast's voice is kind of funny. That is like monster. And like, we've seen Disney's version and it's the growling. And then we meet this beast and it's like, it's just like, that's a very interesting voice to come out of that face.
Yeah.
I am Libby.
Yeah, I like that it's, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I like the Tony hits.
No, it's great. I mean, it's just, it's jarring when it starts.
Yeah.
It was like, what are you doing with my rose? And you're like, what?
Yeah, because it's just, you know, Jean Marais.
Yeah, just again, Jean Marais doing a voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything set at the castle, like in the castle with the dad and then in and around the castle with Belle is stunning and beautiful and magical, and everyone knows this. But then every time we go back to the house, it's just like, man, I really want to go back to the castle.
Yeah.
I think that's the point.
And I was kind of wondering why there's so much of it, but I think
is it one of those medieval movies where just the medieval times suck?
Well, I think...
It's not that it's medieval. It's clearly after that, but...
Like, I don't know. I think
it's like because 1600s, probably.
Because if you want to have the moment where she doesn't make it back, you need a reason. And if you want to have the moment where, like, the brother and the friend come to the castle, you need a reason.
I get it. I get for plot reason.
So I think it works for me for that.
Yes. But. I love the teleporting glove so much. I love the way she uses it. It's like, oh, forgot my keys. Like, literally. Yeah. Oh, forgot my keys. Got to teleport back. The resolution of this movie is such a troll. I love that Cocteau, like, I hate it, but I love that Cocteau was deliberately trolling the audience by like, ha, I turned you into a furry, didn't I? You're sad that Jean Marais is back.
Yeah.
It's like, you're handsome, and she's like, oh.
And I don't know.
Where's my beast?
Yeah, I don't know. And I did always, like, find it kind of strange for, like, the story of Beauty and the Beast for like the whole if the whole story is about like her loving him as a beast, then like he doesn't reward, have to turn
yeah,
back.
Yeah, her reward is that he's now handsome. That's not the yeah. It's a weird moral. It's a weird thing. Yeah. It's a weird ending.
I think it works for me because I like the reverse falling jump up to the clouds. Like, I love all the special effects in this movie.
Yeah, Cocteau is great. Have you seen any of his other films?
I saw part of Blood of a Poet.
Okay.
But it didn't have subtitles and I stopped pretty quick.
Yeah. Blood of the Poet, I'm not a huge fan of. His 1927 film, I think it is. Not a huge fan of Blood of a Poet. Orpheus is fine. It's a good adaptation of that story. Testament of Orpheus is where it's at, though. That's where, hi, I am John Cocteau, and this is about to get very, very meta and still use all of the special effect. And I think that film is much more interesting philosophically as a text. If I want him to tell like a straightforward story, then or just work in wonderful imagery, then I'll take Beauty and the Beast over his other two films any day. But yeah, it's a Yeah, no, it's a beautiful piece of fairy tale, and it's also, you know, a kind of fun meta narrative.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm not gonna call it like one of the greatest films ever. I'm just not, because there's so much of the movie that I'm not enjoying, even if it's on purpose that I'm not supposed to be enjoying it, but I just don't enjoy it.
River.
it's so telling that like we cut back to the house to have the funny like everything's being taken away scene. The creditor or moneylender is coming to take everything away, and it's funny that they take away the chess set, right? But I don't care about that scene. I just want to go back to the castle. And when we're back at the thing and we just cut for one shot back to the castle and the beast wandering through the room, and I'm like, ah. And then we cut away and I'm like, why? Like, yeah. So I find it's a frustrating watch is my problem with it. And even if it's on purpose, I still find it frustrating.
I love all the scenes with Josette Day and Jean Marais are great. I love them together. I love that she's confident.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not gonna...
No, she's a great character in this.
She doesn't put up with him. Mm-hmm. She just tells him, you know, get your act together.
Yeah.
when he's, like, trying to be all, like, sad and dramatic, she's just like, come on, get it together. I like how vulnerable he is.
Mm-hmm.
And I like he kind of just, like, he puts all his cards on the table, you know, shows her, like, you know, all the bad stuff about him.
Mm-hmm.
And is just like,
But please love me.
And so, yeah, I think it's just super satisfying
mm-hmm.
when that's rewarded.
Yeah. I love the line... Are you disappointed that I look like your brother's friend? Yes.
And then she's like, no. I feel like I'm in the movie being like, whoa, I need to unpack this for just a sec.
Beauty and the Beast. It's a classic for a reason.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's on my wall. Literally. Mm-hmm. It's on the wall, and it's also on my wall, the poster.
Mm-hmm.
I like the poster because it captures that ethereal, magical feel, of the film. I admire it more than I enjoy it. Mm. And kind of like how I could always put on the second half of the Philadelphia Story, I could probably always put on the castle sequences of Beauty and the Beast.
I think like the non-castle stuff doesn't bother me that much. Like I like it fine. Like I don't like it as much, but you know, so I think the movie probably works a bit better for me.
All right, and then we had to watch at least one more Ingmar Bergman film before we packed up the box. Because it's Ingmar Bergman! We've watched so many Ingmar Bergman movies together, and it's been a minute.
Yeah.
Last one we watched, I think, was Through a Glass Darkly. And that was months ago. That was months and months ago. May have even been, like, last summer. I don't know. Anyway, we watched Hour of the Wolf, 1968, starring Max von Sydow and Liv Ullmann, with supporting performances by just all of his regulars. We've got a young, bare-faced Erland Josephson.
And you, like, pointed him out, and then I like hadn't noticed it was him, and then I was like, hold up.
Yeah, because we're used to him like in like After the Rehearsal and Fanny and Alexander, these later, he looks great in a beard. Erlen Josen looked great in a beard, but yeah, he's almost unrecognizable without the beard. Anyway, Hour of the Wolf, Ingmar Bergman's horror movie, plays like an A24 horror movie. Ingmar Bergman did it first. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's pretty great. I feel like I need to rewatch it. I'm not entirely sure like what happened, and I think that's part of the point.
Mm-hmm. It gets very, it's, well, you said it beautifully. You said it was like it has the logic and aesthetic of a nightmare.
Yeah, that like I'm uncomfortable and this feels wrong, but I don't really know why.
Yeah, and also this doesn't really make logical sense. We're kind of teleporting between places, but it is terrifying, so that's what matters.
Yeah.
Basically, men be horny for ex-girlfriends, and that's bad.
Yeah.
And the artist gets real solipsistic and self-destructs. I feel like that's about all we really need to know.
Yeah.
With it. Interesting opening in it has a... Ow. It's just really going for it today.
Don't let her bite your fingers.
It has an interesting meta element in that, like, we hear them setting up for the first shot, and Liv Ullmann throughout the film is just talking to camera about what she thinks has happened here. It's a strange film. I think it's one of his better films, but I can't say that I get it much in the way that I feel like I can more intimately understand his films like Winter Light. Mm. Yeah.
Man. Yeah, I feel like as it was going, I was kind of trying to predict, because like it kind of sets up like that he's drawing these weird, that he's like having a hard time with like his drawing, and he ends up drawing these weird characters, and is telling his wife about them, and then I was kind of like, are we gonna see these people in some capacity? And we do. And so the whole time I was kind of like wondering how is this, you know, how is the I don't know, that element gonna line up, what's going on here? And I don't know.
The dinner sequence is agony.
Yes, the editing for that is so mm-hmm. good.
The editing of the sound, it's just the most awkward dinner party ever. And then a little puppet theater, and you're like, what is going on? We've gone Bride of Frankenstein dinner people.
Yeah.
All of a sudden.
The people who are being friendly and like the
all smiles,
inviting them to dinner, but everything is uncomfortable.
The man who plays Lindhorst would be the perfect Swedish Dracula.
Yes.
Did you enjoy recognizing shots from the board game?
Yeah.
Because this was a film that you hadn't seen before, but you had seen, you know, we played the board game, the Saraband Ensemble, the tabletop game that I made, based on this and many other of Bergman's films. And so I took stills from the movie and incorporated them into the game and into the characters. And so you eventually see all of those shots that are in the game. And so did you catch them?
Yes. Well, I caught it. I know I caught one, and I probably caught others, but I know I caught the one where he finally finds his ex.
Mm-hmm.
and realizes, you know, they're in front of all these people.
Yeah, the shot of him looking up from her, and then also, you know, Baron von Mertens and household. There's that tableau of all of them looking at him, and it's just, it's such a creepy shot. It's such a creepy shot, and it's too well composed. just got the guy lurking in the window. Nah, it's fun times. It's fun creepy times.
Yeah, I really liked it. Yeah.
Three solid pictures.
Yeah.
But they know Dune. Mm. I'm working my way through God Emperor of Dune. It's largely an epistolary in terms of like long letters and excerpts from Leto's journals and interviews and stuff like that. It's reports. So, and then there's also the narrative. It really do be Stalingrad. This is a tyrant who has essentially suppressed all technology except for himself. Everybody's, you know, begging for his handouts. He's essentially starving the universe of spice. And he's doing this very nobly so that people will know once his reign ends to never go under a tyrant again. To never let it happen. Yeah, that's his ultimate.
What?
That's his ultimate plan. He's also got, you know, his own breeding programs going because he is the most human ever to exist because he has all of his ancestors' memories and consciousnesses inside him, and so he is truly the most empathetic being of all time. But his curse is that he must be perceived as a tyrant. And because a genocidal maniac.
Because he is.
For all time. And that's it's such a tragedy. The tragedy of Leto II. And he's real sad about having a religion worshiping him. And
that's really hard for him, I'm sure.
It's this book is bananas. And I see what Herbert's getting at, but like my word, I'm not going to call it a good book. I will call it an interesting, a peculiar one. And it has some good ideas, as you know, and like Leto will just go on these long monologues about like the relationship between governments and gender and armies and gender and like why he wants, and he like goes into like the reason we need all female armies is because all male armies will get gay and violent, and it's just like,
whoa.
It gets, I'm telling
and
you,
and you think all female armies won't?
It's just, it's so bizarre. It's so bizarre. Well, you don't, you know, you see, male queerness will get violent, you see. No, it's so strange. Just stick with Dune and Dune Messiah. You do need Dune Messiah to actually conclude Dune. The story of Paul, and make explicit that, like, no, this guy's terrible.
Yeah.
But anyway, don't go. You don't need to go past. Also, I've skipped Children of Dune. I don't care. yeah. This is wild. This is wild. This is wild times. We've played the game a bunch more.
Yeah.
Tell me about the game.
I really like it.
Yeah, we're still playing two player, two factions each. I got the Tlilaxu expansion, also the Ixians, but I don't care. Mm. Because I don't know who the Ixians are. I kind of know them now because of Dune, but really they only talk about them. I don't actually get to know any of the characters, and it's also 3,500 years in the future, so like I don't know what the Ixians are like at the time of Dune, aka the game, because the game is set during the first book. But yeah, we've got the Talaxu now. And the face dancers are so fun.
Yeah.
I would like you to win more, please.
I'm working on it. We haven't played too many games.
We've played like five yeah. or six.
You've also done all of this research.
This is true, like, but that just doesn't...
constant research and constant thinking about Dune.
That doesn't mean that... I could be thinking all the time about chess. That doesn't mean I'm gonna beat you. Right?
Well, but you have experience thinking about this game. Like...
I don't know. You've played the game. You can win. Yes, but that this is a game... Like, if I make a bad move, then I, you know, lose. I could lose. I, you know. Anyway. Mm. We played with the Bene Gesserit. Mm. And I won with the Bene Gesserit prediction.
Yeah, that was real cool.
That was real fun, where I helped you win. Mm. And then I was like, I helped you win when I thought you would, when I wanted you to, and so I won.
Yeah. And she was giving me advice, and I was like, it's kind of weird that she's giving me advice.
Yeah. And I made my own Nexus cards from the third expansion, so I don't have to buy the third expansion, so we can play with odd numbers of players. Anyway. Yeah, Dune. You like the game?
Mm-hmm.
Do you like it better than chess?
No. I should say, I don't like it in the same way as chess. It's not like, I like it for different reasons.
It's the same thing. You gotta take out your area control.
I like the thematic
it's so thematic.
Elements of Dune. I think that's super cool. I like having multiple political forces involved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like chess for different reasons.
Okay. Why do you like chess?
Because my brain's good at it.
Okay, this is true.
Because it's, I don't know.
We haven't played chess still since Hawaii.
We've played lots of variants.
But we've played variants of chess. We've played Atomic Chess and Sniper Chess and Peasants Revolt.
Mm-hmm.
Shut Up and Sit Down, they're a board game review channel company that I peruse every now and then. And yeah, I watch their chess variants. And I think I've won all of the chess variants that we've played, right?
I won Peasants Revolt.
You won Peasants Revolt? Oh, yeah, that's right. You won Peasants Revolt. Yeah, but Atomic Chess is really fun.
Yeah.
Where when you take a piece, every piece within one space of that gets blown up and taken off the board. And so, yeah, it's fun. Then we have Sniper Chess, which is just like regular chess, except you don't move when you take out another person's piece.
Which is really hard.
It's very hard.
You can't get someone to take your...
You can't sacrifice a piece.
And you can't get someone to go where you want them to go.
Yeah, yeah. It's basically... It's a much more defensive game, where you're basically trying to get other people in your line of sight.
Mm.
As opposed to getting up in their faces. And then Peasants Revolt is just a fun little thing where one person has 8 pawns and one person has 3 rooks or 3 knights. And yeah, and it's just very asymmetrical.
Hmm.
Kind of like, dude! No, it's fun.
Yeah.
You like the chess variants?
Yeah, I don't know. They're fun. Yeah.
Do you like them better than chess?
I don't like them in the same way I like chess.
I
think it's a different...
Is chess your favorite game?
Probably not. I don't know what my favorite game is. But chess is the one that I'm good at.
Right.
And, like, I feel like it... I don't know. It feels different on my brain than other games do.
Sure. Did you just break my zipper, River? Here, hold on.
I think so.
River,
Why? Why do you do this? Eh. River. We interrupt this program to bring you zipping noises. The river is intensely fascinated by. No, stop biting the zipper. Ah, got it.
All
right, we're good.
Hello.
Okay. Dune.
Dune.
We saw it.
Yeah.
Dune Part 2 on IMAX, opening the first showing in Portland, essentially. Oh my stars, this is so much better than Dune Part 1.
Yeah. And I really liked Dune Part 1, and I still say that.
And I think Part 1 is fine, and I like it better now that having seen... I watched it again while you were at work the other day, just to see if my estimation improved. And it did improve, but it really... What it is it's just a 2.5 hour setup. Like, that's, it really isn't a movie on its own. Mm. It really is just a prelude to the actual movie where stuff happens that is Dune Part 2. Which is so weird because book one is the book I like in the book. Is the part one. It's everything building up to the fall. And in this movie... And in this adaptation, the interesting part is everything after that. It is, you know, the second half of Dune. It's Paul Atreides in the desert, rising to become the Messiah, question mark, for the Fremen, and taking back Arrakis and starting the jihad. The Holy War. And it's just as gorgeous. I would say it looks better than the last one.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can tell that they're shooting on actual deserts this time. Like, I rewatched part one again. And, like, the deserts felt a lot more CGI to me. Like, it was less, like, I felt like I was actually looking at someone walking around in the desert. This one, it's clear that they are actually shooting out in the desert. And so it feels so much bigger and expansive. It's a lot less people talking in rooms. Though when we do spend time in rooms, they're very weird looking rooms. Black and white rooms and Gaiety Prime. And then the Emperor's. We go to the Emperor's shindig and like...
Kai Tain.
With Christopher Walken and Florence Pugh. Lea Seydoux.
Ooh.
Charlotte Rampling. Just all the people.
All of them.
What's great about this movie is it actually has ideas. And it talks about them. It's not very subtle. It's, you know, fairly simple. It's not very complex. But... that's more than I can say for Dune Part 1, which I'm not really sure if it has ideas beyond plot. This is a film about religious fanaticism and how that is used to subjugate people. It's about the more insidious ways that we can colonize, that people can colonize people.
that we can colonize people. It is about Palestine. It just is. I loved that it was actually having those discussions. I loved how they changed the character of Chaney.
Mm-hmm.
I love that the series now, if assuming there isn't another one, which there might be, but just assuming with what we have, that this series begins and ends with her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like how anti-imperialist, how anti-colonialist this film is.
I like that it takes the, you know, what... It takes the fall from the first act and kind of weakens that down a little bit and shifts the fall element to the second half.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole thing is building up to Paul's fall. It's not about the into Atreides' tyranny. Fall.
Yeah.
It's about Paul's fall.
into tyranny.
Yeah.
How he is fighting against this idea of being, you know, the Bene Gesserit implanted Messiah. Like, it's not hope that you're offering them. You're offering them essentially servitude to your ways.
Yeah.
Your designs. The Bene Gesserit are the villains of this film. Mm. They're great. They're so weird and creepy and sexy. Mm. Lea Seydoux is so fun.
Mm.
Yeah, I like that they take the hero Paul and they make him kind of suck.
And
he's like, I just want to be part of your people. And then eventually he's just like, well, I guess this is how I get what I want.
Yeah.
Is I gotta become this Messiah. I gotta become this dictator.
Yeah, I liked that. I think one of the tensions I felt while watching it was how at the start he says that he wants to get everyone to believe he's the Messiah, you know, to serve his own ends. He says that outright at the start, that mm-hmm. we got to get everyone to
this
believe
is how we do
I'm
it.
The Messiah.
Yeah.
But then as he kind of gets in with the Fremen more and, you know, talks to Chaney, he doesn't want to use them. Maybe he wants to just be one of them.
There's a great bit where after Jessica has become a reverend mother and they're all like, wow, that's true that he must be the Lisan al-Gaib. And he's like, listen, no, the Bene Gesserit are trained to alter the chemicals in their body. She was trained to alter this poison. This is not a miracle.
Yeah.
This is her doing the thing that as she was always designed to do it. It's set up to make them look bigger than they actually are.
Yeah.
This is not prophecy. This is a plan.
He explains the magic trick.
Yeah.
And hopes that that will work.
Yeah.
And I think for me watching it, there's this tension of how much is he acting?
Mm-hmm.
Is he pretending to be their friend so he can, you know, gain their trust?
Yeah.
Or is he sincere? And, I don't know. I feel like there are these two aspects, and you know, one being the Duke who wants to be the Messiah and have the power to do what he wants and to regain his station,
mm-hmm.
and then there's,
there's
Uzzel who wants to be their friend and fight for them and have a family and have these connections and settle down with them or whatever.
But it just turns out that he's just a really bad communicator.
Yeah.
Like, he's great at giving speeches, but he's not great at having heart-to-hearts.
And there's this bit with the ring, and I feel like his father's ring.
Yeah.
And I feel like the ring represents the first of the two.
The ducal signet.
And he wears it at the start, then takes it off as we get into it, as it seems like he is being more sincere. And then he puts it on towards the end, and it's just mm-hmm. a great moment of, I don't know, of him accepting that fall and realizing he cannot escape it and that he is part of this power play.
Mm-hmm. None of this is explored at all in the Lynch version.
Yeah.
It's just, it's done, but it's not explored at all. In the miniseries, it's kind of there, and it's mostly portrayed by Paul just becoming kind of ruthless. Mm. Yeah, in this one, there's actual conversations about it, and I really like that. I like how Jessica just becomes evil. She just is just like, yes, and we will do this, and we will we will start with the weaker.
I like how she is a character with power who leverages it. That she,
yeah, she has agency.
Yeah, and she worked. You know,
she's not just a crying sad sack that she was in the first one for a lot of it.
No, she has a goal, and she wants to reach it, and yeah. She can.
And in the first part, she is this kind of, like, I'm the good Bene Gesserit, you know? Like, I bore a son because I was gonna, you know, go against the sisterhood.
I'm a rebel.
Yeah, and I truly love my duke. And now in this one, she's like, yeah, but she's still a Bene Gesserit. She's still a colonizer. She's still upholding those terrible values. And at the end, it just means that the Bene Gesserit have still kind of won. It's just not in the way they wanted. The Harkonnens are kind of just not really a factor in this. They're just kind of the thing to be beaten.
And they're also being used by the Bene Gesserit.
Yes. So their agency is kind of taken away in this movie. Like, Austin Butler's, like, you know, fun or whatever. But, yeah, they are the androgynous, fetish-y evil people. Mm. You know, fascist evil people. And, like, this movie, weirdly enough, made me think of the Kenneth Anger film Scorpio Rising, which is Kenneth Anger, gay experimental filmmaker, and his 1968 film Scorpio Rising. So, you know the concept of a soundtrack where, mm-hmm. like, scenes happen to, like, pop music cues?
Yeah.
That comes from this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about gay bikers. And at a certain point in the film, like, the film co-opts, like, Nazi fascist imagery as this queer radical thing.
Mm.
And it's provocative. Like, it's controversial. That was the whole point. But, like, this feels like a straight person trying to tackle that.
Mm.
In this, like, are they queer? Are they fetishy? Are they fascist? Like, are they evil? Like, is it vilifying it? Is it taking it back? I don't know. It's weird. All that really comes across is that Baron Harkonnen is terrible because he's fat. Like, that's really what all there is to it.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So I found the Harkonnens not really interesting. And then watching back, like, they're kind of barely in both versions. They have, like, maybe 8 scenes across 2 movies. What I found much more interesting in this was, you know, was the Emperor and Florence Pugh and the Bene Gesserit and all their stuff in this movie. And so I like that focus.
Yeah. And I think the thing that I really liked about this adaptation was, I think when we talked about Dune earlier, I mentioned that there's, there's the interpretation that in terms of, like, the whole Messiah thing, that it's all political, and there's mm-hmm. the interpretation that he is the Messiah, and that you kind of, you know,
he is the super being,
and that there's ambiguity in other versions, and that I'm not really, I don't know that works for me. I don't know if you can really be ambiguous mm-hmm. there. And I like that this version is not.
Yeah.
In this version, no, he's not the Messiah. Yes, it's all political. It picks.
Yeah.
It picks the story it's going to tell, and it tells it.
Mm-hmm. It does still have the bit of him being like a super being or whatever, like he's the dude that can take the water of life or whatever.
Right.
It still has that he can see the future bit.
but it does not, it is not ambiguous about whether he's a good guy.
No. He, maybe, and, like, maybe he's special in this one way, yeah, but that doesn't make him the Messiah.
Yeah.
He's still a dude who's special in this one way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's gorgeous to look at throughout. The sound design is fantastic. I think the score is used so much better here. There's a lot more variation in it. Listening to the score on its own, I think it's, less of, I think it's like, it's the inverse of Dune Part One, which I think I would rather listen to Dune Part One score. But I think the score is less well integrated into the film, whereas I think the score better fits the film in Dune Part Two. And it's still a great score to listen on its own. I just probably would rather listen to the first one. Maybe it's just because the first one also has like 3 extra hours of Hans Zimmer's just like sketchbook writings and stuff, and so you get like these 20-minute ethereal tracks, which are real fun. But the love theme in the score is so great. It takes a theme that was already in the first part and it just adds a second note underneath as a harmony, and it completely changes the feel of it. It's so much brighter and lighter and fuller. Dune continues to be some of Hans Zimmer's most interesting work for me because of how it incorporates so many of his different styles, his choral, his electronica, his use of and deviation from the concepts of melody. I found this to be the first filmed Dune adaptation that I will just give an unironic recommendation of. All the others I would say are some degree of fine. This one is like, no, this one's, watch this one.
Yeah,
good stuff.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Not to say that I still don't have problems inherent with the material. Like, are you co-opting, like, Islamic, Middle Eastern, African, indigenous imagery? But how responsible, irresponsible are you being? I'm not really sure I'm the one who can comment on that. But I feel like someone should scrutinize and analyze and criticize that. I think its heart is in the right place, but yeah. And then there was a moment in the screening where like people were laughing at Stilgar because turns out he's a zealot. He's a religious zealot, and that's he believes in Paul as the Messiah, unironically.
I did like not all the Fremen.
Yeah, no, they're not a monolith. I really like that.
But
there's moments where the film, where the audience laughs at him. And I feel like Javier Bardem is clearly having a great time playing this big character.
He gives such wholesome energy. I'm not sure how.
Yeah.
But
It's a very distinct performance from Javier Bardem, who is usually playing like Anton Chigurh or like the most brutal and downtrodden of characters, and he's just a happy guy. Yeah. But like, where is the line between portraying the effects of the negative impacts of religious fanaticism and infantilizing these people as being too stupid to see past the farce?
Yeah, because on the one hand, I like that, I don't know, like it supports the narrative that he's not the Messiah if we're not taking belief in him seriously, but also then we're making fun of people.
Yeah, so it's a line. I don't know how, I'm not really sure how well it rides it, but again, the fact that the movie is even attempting to go after all of this stuff.
And, you know, and it does want to please fans of the books, and so it can't, like,
it takes a lot of deviations. I will say that it ignores a huge tide jump. There's no baby between Chani and there's a bunch of changes,
but I don't know, I I feel like a lot of the issues I have with it are embedded in the material it's adapting, mm-hmm. and that it's, I don't know, doing a good job of, I don't know,
talking
about them without...
Yes, as in terms of a contemporary adaptation, it is taking certain elements, not necessarily, maybe not to task, but it's like bringing them up as like, this is something that needs to be discussed.
I know that they know.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I would really be interested in seeing like either an indigenous or a Palestinian or like some. I would like to see that perspective, the occupied perspective, take the helm of a Dune adaptation.
Yeah,
to see what their thoughts on this, you know, story, because you know we've had David Lynch and Denis Villeneuve. And Frank Herbert tell this story up until this point. And these are, you know, these are the dominant, they are the oppressors, essentially. That's their history, their people's history. And so I'd be interested to find a different perspective, to have a different perspective take the helm.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know that...
Same thing with Killers of the Flower Moon. They're very similar movies in a lot of ways, actually. And like, is the romance real between the evil colonizer and the indigenous woman? Mm. Like, is that relationship really there? And like, does it matter? Because he's being awful.
Yeah.
So.
Still a colonizer.
Yeah. I just like that these films are having these conversations. It's great. It's great to have a movie, you know, go woke.
Yeah.
Anyway, any more thoughts? Dune Part 2.
I haven't finished the book.
Yeah.
And
I'm waiting for us to like have to go on like a road trip or something so that we can just listen to it in
and
the car.
And we will in...
I mean, we will when we move, but also we need to, like, take a trip to the Oregon coast, maybe, and then listen to it on that drive. Anyway.
So I've only ever seen the story finished once, which is the Lynch version.
Right.
But, you know, I've heard just...
What happens.
Yeah. I've heard just through, like, talking about the story about, like, the jihad mm-hmm. and in that there being this war that happens. I've heard my mom read the books and tell me about them. I've heard you tell me about them.
Mm-hmm.
I've never understood how the jihad happens. I've never understood where the rationale is. Why
do they just start going out and killing people?
Yeah. How does the story justify this? And I think
that is also something that has been kind of confusing for me.
But I think this adaptation made me see why that would happen.
It just, instead of making it an abstract other worlds, it's the land's red. Does not respect your ascendancy to the throne, which is not a thing that happens in the book.
Mm.
It's a change, but it makes so much sense as to why are we going to war?
We are going to war because if we don't, we could just be destroyed by the Lansrad if they don't like that.
Yeah. He's and the emperor like now. They do not honor the Lisan al Gaib's ascendancy.
Yeah. And to maintain his power, to maintain
His godhood,
and to a certain extent for the if the Fremen support him, for them to maintain control over their planet.
Yeah.
If they want him in control of the planet, he needs to not be threatened by the Lansrad, who could easily just decide, we don't want you ruling.
And we're going to send you down. We're going to send nukes down on Arrakis.
Yeah, you just took power from the Emperor. This isn't.
Yeah,
it's not legal. Or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
That actually is a threat for him to have to annihilate.
It's very clear as to why. Now, there was a bit, there's a big bit in terms of the big climax, and it's the threatening of the destruction of all spice.
Mm-hmm.
That is mentioned in this adaptation and then kind of thrown away.
Yeah.
And I feel like that left me a little bit hanging at the end, where it's like, but they do not can you stop biting? Ow.
where Josh Brolin says, like, sire, they do not acknowledge your ascendancy. And then does Timothée Chalamet just be like, then destroy the spice? Like, he doesn't mention that. And so I'm just like, what about? Like, they mention it, but they don't totally bring it up. There's no guild. Again, the guild are completely absent from these movies. There's no guy going saying, the spice must flow. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, because he does say, if you attack, I'll destroy the spice.
Yeah.
If you attack while I'm here with the Emperor, I'll destroy the spice. But he doesn't apply that threat to any other, you know. He doesn't say, if you don't respect me, I'll destroy the spice.
Yeah. Anyway.